Just checked to make sure that everything is working right here. It looks like it is. Yeah, we're picking it up, all right. And let me just get my notes out. And let me begin by indicating that today is January 26th, 1995. And this is Jim Boning speaking with Edward Donnelly in Bel Air, Florida, just outside of
Clearwater.
I know that you were born in Highland Park, Michigan on the 26th of November, 1921. Could you tell me a little bit about your father and mother and your family background?
Well, my father and mother came from farm communities in Michigan. And my father worked in Detroit for a few years in the 20s, before the Depression. Then when the Depression came, we moved, left Detroit. He was unemployed and settled on a family farm that had been in my father's family for several generations. And we lived there throughout the Depression and until I went away to college in 1939. My father and mother had both been in their youth school teachers. In those days, they had what they called normal schools in Michigan and in other states, where a person could go to these schools for 2 years and get a teacher's, I don't know what it was called, a teacher's certificate or something like that, which made them eligible to teach in the public schools. And both of them did that for a few years. But then from the beginning of the Depression on, my dad and all of us went back to the business that he'd been in when he was a child, and his father before him, of working the land on the farm.
Mm-hmm. And where did you receive your very early schooling?
I went to the local schools there. In the grade school, I went to it was called the Pledgett School. It was in that area. In those times, they had a one-room schoolhouses dotted around the countryside. They were separated by about 2 or 3 miles. The one that was whose district we lived in was about a mile and a half from where we lived, and I went to that school. And I'm very active in education reform now. I think there's a lot to be said for the old one-room schoolhouse with one teacher and 8 grades in the school. It was just had one room, and instead of the teacher, is the conventional practice now, standing and lecturing to a class of kids all the same age. These kids learn from each other. Mm-hmm. And it was there was a real sense of community in that little school room. So, but anyway, that's what I did. And then when I went to high school, I went to a local small high school. When I graduated, there were 8 kids in my graduating class.
And the high school was where then?
That was in a town. Well, the town has since disappeared. It was the name of the town was Lenox. But it was just a little small community, and it's now doesn't exist anymore. It's been incorporated in a somewhat larger town called Richmond.
Richmond, okay.
And that's in Macomb County in Michigan.
You were the oldest of 6 children?
8 children.
8 children?
Yeah.
Okay. It must have been difficult times with the Depression living off the land, as you say.
Well, it was difficult, and we were poor. But everybody was poor. This is a house that was built by my great-grandfather in the 1850s, and that's where we lived. That still exists. We still own the land around it, and pay the taxes and rent the land. Our Inez and my three children and our other, their equivalent from the other branches of our family, treat this old house now as kind of a shrine.
I can imagine, yes.
Because our family lived there for 100 years.
It's incredible.
Of course, the ones who think it's wonderful to preserve that shrine are not the generation that presently pay the taxes.
Is it pretty much growing up around there now?
No, it's still pretty rural.
Still pretty rural.
Yeah. That's at the north end of the county. And the industrialization is at the south end of the county. That's in the school congressional district represented by Mr. Bonnier, the Democratic whip in the House now. When my great-grandfather came there in 1850, came in 1848, I think the house was built in 1850. It was on the edge of civilization, really. And he bought the land and worked it, and then his son did, and then his son, my father, did, and we did when we were children.
Mm. When you got to high school, had you given any thought as to what you wanted to do beyond that? Besides farming?
Yeah, my mother and father, my mother in particular, but my father too, always talked about the university. When I look back on it now, I don't know what university they meant. I guess they meant the University of Michigan. But it was just a foregone conclusion that our family, myself and my brothers and sister, would go to the university. When I finished high school, I didn't have any idea how to go to the university, and we didn't have high school counselors or anything. In fact, nobody in the high school that I went to, that rural high school, I don't think anyone had ever gone to college. Nobody in my class of eight students did. And I hitchhiked out to Ann Arbor one day when I was about 16 and talked to the people there. And it just was no way to, I could get a job in an old hotel there, but it just wasn't enough. I couldn't put the thing together for the tuition and so forth, even in a state university. And then, to my dismay, I found out that the high school that I was just about to graduate from was not accredited by the University of Michigan. So I gave up that idea, and I went to try to get a job, and there weren't any jobs. And my father didn't want me to stay on the farm. He wanted me to go and do something different. And so I joined the CCC, the thing that the Roosevelt administration.
Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yeah. And I was sent to a place in northern Michigan, and it was run by the Army in those days. And the commanding officer of the place I was a Major Hambleton. You going somewhere now?
I'm off to get my hair done.
Oh, okay.
It's a weekly ritual.
See you later.
So good to see you and have a productive meeting.
Thank you.
He took me out of the field forces where they were planting trees and so forth, and made me his clerk in the office. And so I had a lot of, I didn't really have much to do there. And so I spent a lot of time writing letters to colleges, every place I could think of. And I'd had all A's in my high school transcript. And so finally, late that summer, I got a letter from Lawrence Tech inviting me to come to school there and offering free tuition semester by semester as long as I maintained a B-plus average. So I was in Detroit, and I had confidence that I could get some kind of part-time work in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So I went down there and went to school, got a job at, as I knew I thought I could, I did get a job at Sears Roebuck and worked there in evenings and Saturdays and had the free tuition. And so I, 4 years later, I got my engineering degree.
Were there dormitories on campus, or did you live in a rooming house?
Rooming houses, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Lawrence Tech has gone. I just retired from that board. I was chairman there for many years, and Lloyd Royce, the former president of General Motors, has been on the board a long time. He's chairman now, and we have a new president. But the college, now called the university, has a history parallel to Air Products, and I played a comparable role, I guess, in both of these institutions. When I went to Lawrence Tech, it was a new school which had been created in 1932 or 3 by the Dr. Lawrence, who had been dean of engineering at the University of Detroit and had some conflict with the management there. And it had at that, when I went there, it had 300 or 400 students, and it was operated from rented facilities. Now today, 50 odd years later, it's on a really striking modernistic campus in Southfield outside of Detroit. Has 6,000 students, mm-hmm. And it's got a very limited endowment, unfortunately, but it came from just a little seed into a really very significant institution.
Wilkes College started in 1933, and that's a very unusual time to be starting an educational institution in the depth of the Depression.
Yeah. Well, I'm jumping around, but before I got my degree, I was working on various things. Some courses I took in the evening, some courses I took in the day, and I had different kinds of jobs. And I got a job then at Air Products in the spring of 1943, before I got my degree in June. And I worked part-time at Air Products, got paid 70 cents an hour. But it was a new company. It had, I think it was 10 employees, but the records aren't clear anymore, but it was a very small number of employees, and so...
Was this in Detroit, or the Detroit area?
Yeah, it was in Detroit at that time. And so I had a marvelous experience of seeing and participating in Lawrence Tech growing from a very questionable whether it would survive type of school into a well-established institution, and Air Products the same thing.
You said Lawrence Tech had about 400 when you went there. What were the faculty like, and did it emphasize engineering?
Yeah, the faculty in that time were mostly colleagues of associates of Dr. Lawrence, who, as I said, had been dean at University of Detroit. And there were, maybe a half a dozen permanent faculty. A relative of Dr. Lawrence was the administrative officer who ran the administration, and most of the other faculty were what we would now call adjunct professors who were in the engineering department at Ford or Chrysler or General Motors mostly, and came there and taught a few courses.
Mechanical engineering was the thrust That was the emphasis?
Yeah, mechanical, well, and architecture. Today, the university produces mostly undergraduate degrees, but give a smattering of master's degrees in business and engineering and architecture. But it's still a small target school with those disciplines, and they existed then. Engineering and architecture were the predominant curricula even back in those days. And architecture there then and still means mostly industrial architecture, so that graduates of that school of architecture generally get jobs in big companies or architectural firms doing work for industrial manufacturing companies and things of that sort. There was for many years, and while I was there too, a degree in chemical engineering, but that's not the course I took. I took the course in mechanical engineering.
Was there any reason why you selected mechanical engineering?
I think that I felt that I could master that easier than chemical engineering because the high school education that I had, I had never had a course in chemistry or it just wasn't a very advanced high school.
Mathematics, was that a strong point in your background?
Not in high school. And in college, I really had a tough time with math because I had to preserve this B plus average or I lost my scholarship. And it was hard for me to, because there were a lot of kids in the Lawrence Tech in those days who'd gone to really good high schools, like Cass Technical High School in Detroit, for example, was preeminent. And I don't remember what level of mathematics they had, but I had never had a course in algebra even until I got in college. And I remember, boy, differential equations put fear in my heart.
The war was going on.
The war was going on. The war started, of course, in 39, and then in 41 when the United States got in. And I was deferred from military service while I was in the undergraduate school. And then I tried, at one time I was overcome with a patriotic fever, and I tried to enlist in the officer training school in the Air Force. And it was discovered that I had a mild heart murmur. That was fairly early in the war, where that was a knockout as far as an officer training school was concerned. So I just went back to school and stuck to it. And then by the time I got into my senior year, and the Army and the military, all the services were really drafting people that would not have been eligible in the early part of the war. But by then I was working at Air Products, and we had these military contracts, and resulted in me not being drafted.
When you had this first job with Air Products before you graduated from Lawrence, what were you doing? What was your assignment?
I was doing mechanical drafting. I was taking quite a few morning classes then, and I would come to an Air Products office was near the school, a mile away, and I would come to the company at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and the company only had 2 or 3 engineers at that time, maybe 4, and they were working on these designs mostly for the military, and so they'd have design layouts, and then I would take and start making the detailed drawings on the drafting board, and I could stay there as long as I wanted until 8, 9 o'clock at night and get paid my 70 cents an hour. And so that's what I did. And then in June of that year, which was 1943, I got the degree. And it's a degree called, there were two alternatives in degrees, and nobody outside the campus knew the difference between them or even cared. One was a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering, and the other was Bachelor of Mechanical Engineering. The difference between the two was that to get a Bachelor of Mechanical Engineering, you had to do a project and a research and write on it. And on the campus, the Mechanical Engineering degree was considered much more significant than a Bachelor of Science degree. So I went for that degree, and I set up an experiment to measure the heat transfer coefficient on heat exchangers, which related to what I was doing at Air Products. And so I had to intertwine afternoons and evenings at Air Products with conducting my research project as well.
How many students graduated with you?
I would say it was about 60.
Mm-hmm. Had the war taken a number of students away?
Well, as time went on, the war did take a number of students mm-hmm. away, yeah. And so in the class of 43, as I recall, had, I think, about 60. The class of 44 had maybe 20 or mm-hmm. something like mm-hmm. that, and I've forgotten it. Subsequent years it started to build up, and then the company moved to Tennessee. We were there during the war. Then when the war ended, we moved to Pennsylvania, and it was probably about 1950 or something. Dr. Lawrence had died. His younger brother was president of college. And he asked me to join the Board of Trustees, which I did. And then after a few years, I became chairman. And I continued that activity all the years I was at Air Products until last year, 1994. I became emeritus chairman, and the other guy became chairman.
So you were chair 45 years or so, something like that?
No, I must be off on, I think it was 25 years. So I must be off on a date somehow. It was... I was on the board for some years before I became chair.
Okay, so you were on the board 45 years or
something like that, yeah.
Was it preordained you go to Air Products when you got your degree?
No. I didn't know where I would go. And I hadn't even heard of Air Products. And I met Leonard Poole. He was always interested in engineers and engineering. He wasn't trained as an engineer, but he had an intuitive judgment about engineering and about technology, and particularly the commercial side of marketing technology. And he used to come over there on the campus and talk to professors and students. And I met him, and I've forgotten exactly the details, but somehow came to be offered a job working part-time at Air Products first, mm-hmm. and later full-time. And the company had, you might be interested in this briefly, the war was going on, and the German Air Force was bombing London, and the British were making the initial bombing raids over Germany, and of course American, U.S. It was Army Air Corps in those days. U.S. Air officers were observing those things, and if you recall, the first Royal Air Force bombing over Germany was devastating to the British. The Germans had anti-aircraft guns mm-hmm. that knocked them out of the sky, and it became clear that in order to carry out operations of this kind, that the aircraft would have to get at very high altitude. And that meant they had to have oxygen for the pilot breathing. And the concept on which Air Products had been created was that rather than producing oxygen in large central industrial gas plants and delivering them to users, that for large users you could develop a miniaturized plant and extract oxygen from the air on site and pipe it into the steel mill or whatever. Leonard Poole had, with Carl Anderson, had started the company based on developing that concept, and we're working on it, and we're undercapitalized and really we're broke. The military, it was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, let out an inquiry for developing a portable unit for extracting oxygen from the air that would be of such size it could be transported by air to air bases around the world. And there were several large corporations who bid on that, an Air Products bid, but Air Products had already been working on the idea for commercial purposes and more quickly than anybody else, and that's when I came to work the first time when I worked part-time, that was just getting underway, and developed what became a successful U.S. government-accepted model. And then the government wanted hundreds of these built in Detroit. If you can believe it or not, now Detroit had negative unemployment in those days, so the government had set up a factory in Chattanooga, which they intended originally to manufacture tanks, so they sent Air Products to Chattanooga, and we only had I think 19 people who went there and moved into this partially completed factory and started manufacturing these things and did that on till the end of the war.